My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's Arts and Seizures with your host, Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
All right, welcome back. Here we are, broadcasting live from Roberta's.
Welcome.
Well, tippling already, Judy, getting ready for your favorite time of year. The holiday season is fast approaching.
Well, we have to get through Thanksgiving first. That's not my favorite holiday.
And Hanukkah.
And Thanksgiving a cup.
Thanksgiving a cup, which is, I guess, Hanukkah, some interweb Hanukkah sort of invention. I like Thanksgiving, actually. It's a lot of food. There's no that messy gift giving to get in the way.
I like presents.
I like getting presents, too, but, you know, I don't go shopping for Thanksgiving, basically.
So you're a guest. You don't cook.
I do cook, actually, and I may be making Thanksgiving this year. It's undetermined. I'm thinking about cooking a duck this year. Say why a duck. That was your cue.
Why a duck, Mike?
Our good friends at Heritage Foods might have a duck for me this year.
Wow.
So
you get paid in ducks for this show. What do I get? I get shit.
You get pizza.
I get pizza.
You get pizza.
Yeah,
you can have a duck, too. I know the boss. I'll talk
duck.
To you.
I don't want a duck.
I'm thinking a duck this year might be nice. I'm thinking maybe a nice chestnut stuffing with a duck, don't you think? No?
That
Mike, what do you think?
That sounds gorgeous.
Okay, you can come, too.
Yay.
We should introduce our guest.
I'm thrilled. One of my very, very favorite guests that we've ever had, making an encore performance, a return to the formerly Mike and Judy show.
Mike Albo.
All right.
Hey, welcome,
Yay.
Mike.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, you guys.
This is awesome.
The reason we're having Mike on the show, besides the fact that he's handsome and funny, is that he has a show playing now at Dixon Place. Next weekend is your last chance to see it until someone else picks it up. Dixon Place at 10 o'clock on Christie Street. It's called The Junket. Thanks for coming, Mike.
Thank you.
You're on the fast track to Broadway. I'm sure of it.
That would be amazing if I got to Broadway with this show.
Well, you know, I think I just saw Fun Home, too. And that has a darker tenor, and I think that's going to go to Broadway. I see no reason why yours shouldn't.
Yeah, I get nervous about those shows going to Broadway. I wish there was just, you know, like what happened with Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which was so, so good, and then it went to Broadway, and then somehow it lost its
luster. Its dark. Well, I don't know how they're going to keep, like, a closeted suicidal dad. Like, how they're going to put a spin on that one.
Like, right, the Kansans who come to New York really want to see that show.
Yeah.
Well, they put up Spider-Man, which is basically about a failed professional wrestler.
Yes, I don't know.
True.
So that
was not the elevator pitch, though. That's not what it was.
Right.
Not
what got them.
But Junk at the Play is based on the Kindle single of the same name. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Mike?
Sure. Okay, so, I'll do it in the fictional way that I tell it. I used to write for a major newspaper.
Not the Post or the Daily News.
No.
In
the show I call it the New York Tomes, for legal reasons. And I was a columnist for them. I was a freelancer. I didn't get any health insurance or pension plan or anything.
You probably didn't have an office in the building, I'm guessing.
I went to the office once, and that was it, for a little tour, like they threw me a bone. And then I was asked to go on a press junket, which I went on, and it was this, like, crazy, like, insane bukkake version of a junket. It was like... cross-promoted by 1,000 different brands, and it went to Jamaica, which is really weird for a gay person to go to anyway. And then I went on it and came back and became sort of a gossip item by this strange reporter who thought that it would be a good idea to sort of expose that I went on this trip because it goes against the Tomes code of ethics. And then I became sort of this scapegoat in a war between old and new media as they sort of duke it out for the ever-dwindling attention dollars of
Well, basically,
readers.
It's faux scandal and bullshit outrage. And, I mean, reading the junket, I mean, I'm just like, I'd like to strangle the guy that, you know, that outed you, such as it was, for, you know, taking this trip, which really had nothing to do with your gig at the Times. And all of a sudden, oh, my God, look at the guy for the Times. You know, he got airplane tickets, and let's get him fired.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'd like to beat that kid to a fucking pulp, frankly.
I do, too. But I don't wish violence on people. But, I, you know, of course, the Tomes should have an ethics policy. Of course they should. And, you know,
it would be
no
one thing if they followed it themselves, though.
Jesus, that's what I was about to say. It's just, you know, to me, it's like fewer jobs are actually created in these places. Like, they can't really hold you to their rules if they're not giving you a salary. To me, my time is my own time. That is my whole point.
Like, yeah, because the Tomes wasn't the only outlet for your writing.
Right, exactly.
You know, and you had a career.
Yeah, and if they really wanted to dig deep, I was already a conflict of interest for them. For example, I wrote a profile of the guys who work at Urban Outfitters, who started Urban Outfitters, the CEO and the head buyer, and wrote. I went to dinner with them. You know, they invited me after the article came out. They invited me to dinner. We became friends. So is that a conflict of interest? And, you know, I think my question is, everyone is part of the mess. I would say Roberta Smith, who writes the art column, is married to Jerry Saltz, who and I'm sure they have a fabulous art collection. You know what I mean?
And David Pogue, I'm sure he never got a free Mac computer. Or
hello.
Well,
yeah.
you know, I think that full disclosure in parentheses is the new with all due respect. Meaning, if I say with all due respect, it gives me impunity to follow it with "you're a cunt."
Right.
Yeah, but that's not how it works. So if I just say, you know, full exposure, you know, full disclosure. That I'm, you know, married to the guy I'm writing about, it doesn't really forgive you for being that close to your subject or having a real conflict of interest. And really, when you look at the style section especially, it's one big giant reach around. I mean,
totally.
It is, you know, it is such an inbred clusterfuck. It's really gross.
Mm-hmm.
Icky.
Well, at Condé Nast, where you also work, like, the gifts that editors get there is insane.
It's totally insane. I'm, you know, it might be different now, but back in when I worked there in 2003, yes, the gift... The swag that people got was hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I worked at Allure Short for a brief period fact-checking, which was probably one of the most depressing jobs I ever had in my life. And I delivered auto parts. But, but yeah, every day it was just like carts full of crap for these people. And when I was a music writer, we could just got free shit all the time. And I would supplement my income by just selling CDs.
Yeah, that's what one of my editors did. They made hundreds of extra dollars doing that. It's part of our culture. I mean, we live in a consumer culture. And I think that's what I really wanted to point out was, like, you know, other cultures had dictators that they had to deal with. And our dictator is consumerism. Mm-hmm. And we're all a part of it. We're all part of the mess.
I like the part where you say, you know, one of the pieces of swag you got that was branded was just a water bottle, one of those cheap plastic water bottles. And, you know, if you live in New York City, you can't walk out your fucking door without someone handing you one of those.
Yeah.
Your whole life is a conflict of interest.
Yeah, exactly. You get a free calendar, you get a free T-shirt, you get free everything. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, my boyfriend, his favorite kind of T-shirts are free. Like, oh, right. It'll say any stupid crap on it. And he's like, isn't this a great shirt? Like, no, just because it's free doesn't mean you have to take it.
Totally.
Give it to the Salvation, Army.
Wait, just because it's free. Say that again?
Just because it's free doesn't mean you have to take it.
Okay, 6,000 years of heritage that's conflicting with, but okay, I want to think about that.
Well, it's like how open, I would rather not go to an open bar.
That's so true. But, you know, there was a point, though, there was definitely a tipping point when I figured out I'd rather pay for it and hang out with better people than wait in line and hang out with a bunch of jerk-offs just because the booze was free. But, you know, I was probably in my late 20s when I sorted that out. It was the first time I actually had enough money to actually go to a bar, you know.
I feel like open bars are really rare these days. I never.
Well, yeah, they are. Yeah. I guess I'm really dating myself.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I fucking hate. It's so 90s. Is vodka sponsors.
It's not as bad as Hennessy. I went to a paper magazine party that was sponsored by Hennessy.
I see. I dig that.
And they were making Hennessy martinis.
Oh God!
Well, I'll just leave out everything except the Hennessy. 86 the rest, because I like to drink cognac. But you know, all these like fly by night celebrity vodka brands or disco vodka brands or whatever. It's like, okay, it's gonna be Mike and Judy's vodka this week, and we're gonna be mixing Mike and Judy Cosmos. And like, I don't drink vodka anyway.
Signature cocktail. Is
the signature cocktail.
Yeah, so, I remember going to some Out magazine party, and I can't remember the liquor, but it was like this kind of tasted like Dimetap, medicine. I had the worst hangover for like 8 days afterwards. It was disgusting.
Yeah, I was at the boat, the frying pan, and the only sponsor was Jägermeister, and it was like really far from everything. It's just like Jägermeister or nothing.
Jägermeister on a boat, the big purple yawn.
I know, and it's so awful because you put something free in front of me, and I will just like kill myself. I'll like engorge myself till I die.
it's terrible because even if I have money in my pocket, free shit is pretty cool.
Totally.
I guess I'm like Jägermeister. I just went thirsty. What convinced you that turning the junket, like how did you come up with turning it into a play, which is so fucking funny and everyone should go see it?
Oh, thank you. I have to really credit my director, David Schweitzer, who is kind of like this amazing A-list director who graciously gave me time to work on this. And he, you know, I hadn't done a solo show in a long time. And it's weird. The further you get from doing it, the more like low self-esteem you have about doing a solo show. And David really was like, this is your next solo show. I think you should really do this. And so we worked on it for about a year, kind of just, you know, the other interesting thing is I was like, great, I'll do it. I have it already written. I'll just do it and memorize it. Fine. But, you know, the writing is so different between the junket and the show. And it's really interesting how things don't work on the page that work on stage. Do you know what I mean? And having to go through that whole process of changing it to make it more live, it was a long process, actually.
I'm sure. And the graphics are really funny too.
Yeah.
Your
fake logos.
Yeah,
and stuff.
The fake logos are pretty genius. Yeah.
That's my friend Larry Shea, who's a video designer, and he's great. I've known him since I was 17. We share the same sense of humor, so it was very easy to work with him.
Yeah, it's such an entertaining show. I mean, it was packed the night I was there. I told Mike I think that Riken was there, which was very. I'm still not 100% sure, but he sounded like him. I just wanted to hear him say Rodney.
Oh my God! Oh, don't get me started on the A-list. I love that show so much.
Me too.
I miss it. Why isn't it around anymore?
I don't know. It's not fair. It was it really the best isn't. Show.
It was so good.
And then that Mike Ruiz, the only one who really had a career.
Right.
Like, poor him.
I know.
You watching much reality TV these days, Mike? Because honestly, I kind of got burned out on it. I barely turned the television
I got
on
into,
at all.
I got hooked into the last season of Project Runway. I watched that.
As you know, I was the first straight man to actually watch Project Runway and embrace it.
Congratulations.
It's true.
That's amazing. I love that show.
And the first season I saw Tim Gunn on the street, I was so excited. And oh I God. Was calling my friends. I was like, oh my God, I just saw Tim Gunn. I mean, I called like 10 people before I realized I either had to call a gay friend or a woman.
Well, did you see his... I was so disappointed. They did a slideshow of his apartment in the Post last week. His apartment is so depressing and granny. Really? It's really
He is a big granny.
He is a big granny. He hasn't... Well, I remember reading a long time ago that he had one great love, and then he hasn't ever dated
had
since.
Sex in like 30 years.
He's like Mrs. Havisham, who's the character in Great Expectations.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what his apartment looks like? Like,
no.
Like a wedding cake collecting cobwebs on
I
a
would
table.
Like that.
It's always set.
No, it's more like Connecticut grandma. Tasteful,
I can see that.
I wish he would have a love life.
I wish he would have a love life too. And then, you know, with like maybe that guy from Queer Eye, the decorator guy, Tom Felicia. And redo it a little bit.
Yeah. That would be a good couple.
Queer Eye, those guys, that's not on anymore, right?
No.
Those guys all go on to have careers after that?
I think they do pretty well for themselves. Yeah. I see them on the street all the time. It's kind of like, you know how like the only reason you live in New York is to see a star?
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yes.
It's really the only reason I pay rent to live in this dumb city.
Well, we pay a high premium, so I step out my door if I don't see David Bowie, you know, in the first 30 minutes. It's like, I talk
I know,
to my
I get
you
totally
know,
pissed. I get totally
know,
pissed.
Talk to the landlords, I'm paying too much.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to see the opening of the Jacksonian the other night with the Beth Henley play I met Ed Harris and
wow
yeah he's pretty hot
See, so maybe I was hallucinating, Riken, when I saw your show, because it had been so long since I saw a celebrity. I was like,
you were like,
oh my God,
desperate for one.
Yeah, yeah. I needed Riken. Wait,
in your neighborhood, you don't see celebrities like constantly?
You know who we see? I see models. I'm like, oh,
there's
I know.
There's so many
she's
goddamn
model.
Models in Williamsburg.
There's a million of them. Yeah. I saw Alexa Chung once and her, like, Arctic Monkey back when they were together. Yeah, I mean, Madonna eats in my neighborhood now.
I understand they're knocking down your building to build a home for wayward bottles.
It's so depressing. We're negotiating with our landlord right now, and he's, you know, because we're rent stabilized, so fuck you.
Right.
And he's just like, what? Their apartments are so small. And it's like, yeah, to get a 500-square-foot one-bedroom in Williamsburg is $750,000. So, I mean...
It's crazy. I love the part in your book, we were talking about this before, when you said it was 1999 when the rich people stopped hanging out in society.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a turning point somewhere along the line when the city definitely, I was feeling it was two cities, like our mayor-elect, Bill de Blasio, you know, sold his whole campaign on basically mm-hmm. the tale of two cities. And I believe it, and I really feel it. It was very, I liked what you had to say about it, because reading it, and I live in New York for the same reasons we all do. I've been fighting it, and you know, we're all kind of struggling writers and authors. But yeah, it's so much different now.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. I was so curious because I you know, in the show I talk about it too. I sort of create this character. Well, he's based on a real person, but this rich guy that I met when I first lived in New York. And we used to be friends, and then we sort of drifted apart, and I don't know if it was because of our age or was because of, like, the split of classes, but
it's like a caste system. It's like it's like Planet of the Apes. The orangutans no longer hang out with the chimpanzees,
right.
And fuck you if you're a gorilla.
Right. And, you know, and it's perfectly physicalized by the state, by T Magazine, like, which is a symbol to me of this sort of alternate luxury sphere. You know, that exists that I'm not a part of, clearly.
I read this one blog by the woman who started Lucky, and I like her. It's like a little shopping blog she does. And I'll be like, oh, that's such a cute shirt. And then it's $600. And
right.
She's just like, should I buy it?
Oh, God, I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, the question is, if you suddenly had all the money that you ever could possibly want, if money really were no object, would you buy that $600 shirt then? If you had $20 million in your ATM account, would you start buying, you know, $5,000 pairs of socks?
Yeah.
You know, or a cigarette boat.
Would you, Mike?
I don't know.
I mean, and... Oh, it's so funny. My friend, this is an amazing example of things. My friend told me she was watching a rerun of Different Strokes, and it was the episode where Mr. Drummond was going to get evicted, and the kids were just like, oh no, we're going to have to live on the streets again. Oh my God. And then the landlord raised the rent to $30,000. And my friend did like this quick math and realized that they were paying for their apartment. Their penthouse, Mr. Drummond's apartment, was $1,200 a month.
Wait, could you see a remake of Different Strokes, though, with Tim Gunn as the Mr. Drummond?
Oh, that'd be so sweet.
Yeah.
Maybe. $1,200. Yeah, I know. You can't even buy, like...
$1,200.
No. The bathroom will be in the hall for that. And you'd be... I mean, we're looking at apartments maybe to buy. We're looking out in Kensington, Jackson Heights.
The only place I'll be able to afford an apartment is Darfur at this point. And I think the rents are really high there now. So I don't know what I'm going to do.
Well, you're okay, right? I mean...
Every month is a little weird at my place. I have a kind of... I pay cash every month. My landlord's crazy. And
old school.
Yeah.
Old school New York crazy
and
landlord.
Every now and then he tries to like raise the rent, or suddenly he wants to fix the windows and he needs some more money, and I don't know what I'm going to do. So it's sort of like every month I'm like, am I still here? Am I still here?
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, because I've lived in Williamsburg since 1994, and when I moved there, me and a roommate split a big house a half a block from the train, the first stop, for $900. So I was paying $450. She was paying $450. Now,
and you remember when the first ATM machine came to Williamsburg?
It
was like the New Deal. It was like FDR bringing electricity to the rural areas of America.
Right.
Look, a bank machine.
But like, you know, and if we weren't getting this, hopefully getting this buyout from our landlord, like I don't know where we would move because the studios down the street are like over $2,000 a month.
Yeah.
Yes, there's like water features in the building and a courtyard and like a freelancer bench.
It's really the values of things are it, and you know how you try to convince yourself that it's always like value has always been relative.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name. There's this memoir by this New Yorker writer who is writing about like his time in New York from the 60s until the 80s. And he published a short story, got $1,000 for it, and it helped him because his rent was $75. So there was a time when writers could actually get by.
Well, you know, I have to say, I've always been blessed by the cheap rent fairy.
Yeah.
Like, since I moved here, I have not paid over $600.
Wow.
Like, I moved here in 1988. I do my best to always hook people up with housing. Like, I'm really good like that because I realize how karmically, like, in debt I am, and nobody feels sorry for me, I know.
I got the good housing fairy too. I was blessed. When I got my place, I mean, I was making money and I did someone a favor and I sort of got this kind of fire sale on a nice apartment. Someone wanted to sell it like that, and I got really this great deal. But had I not been living in Manhattan for 20 years and had those connections and really put it out to the universe, I couldn't just walk in here and it would have happened. You know?
Yeah.
And it would never happen again in my life, especially after 9/11 and that recession, which kind of really through the whole magazine industry completely out of whack. And that's what I did. I was a magazine guy because I reinvented myself as a book guy. And, publishing, we're all getting rich on that.
Right. I know.
I was very fortunate. But had I not been here for 20 plus years before that, there's no fucking way it would happen. I couldn't imagine moving here like we all thought of. I just moved across the river, as did Judy. But to come here from anywhere and not be loaded, how?
Yeah.
How do you do it?
Yeah.
I think you do it by collecting a lot of swag. Because I'm doing a little lead-in to Mike's performance here. Did you see that?
That was really good.
Mike's going to do a little piece of his play that you should all go see.
The Junket.
Sure, okay. When you write about clothing and shopping in stores, sometimes, if you're lucky, you'll get a free pair of jeans or a pair of sneakers or at least some free booze at a party. In Soviet Russia, they called it blat, black market deals, free goods and services to get ahead. In our world, we call it swag, and swag is everywhere, and we've all had it. Swag is that gift bag you get at a launch party. It's that t-shirt they hand you when you leave a benefit. It's even that water bottle they hurl at you from a gay pride float. And over the years, it's these swaggy scraps that have kept me clothed, hydrated, and partially fed in the city I can't afford. Who knows what kind of swag you get when you're a staff writer at the Tomes, and you're going to Paris with Karl Lagerfeld for the fashion shows, or you're in a mansion in the Hamptons talking to a Wall Street insider. Or maybe it's 2003, and you're having lunch with Colin Powell. And over a seared scallop salad at Per Se, he tells you that there just might be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And so you write an article, and a war breaks out, and thousands of people are killed, and our economy is in tatters. And then you find out that there might not be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Oops. Oh well. At least that salad was delicious.
Does Judy Miller still have a job?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, people are getting outraged because, the shopping freelancer, took a little junket, and meanwhile, much more crimes going on. Speaking of swag, I mean, I climbed the ladder. Because I started out with the school paper when I was in college, when I was at NYU, and someone said, hey, you want to review a record? And I got a free record, vinyl LP, because that was the existing technology at the time, was a 12-inch piece of plastic. And I thought, this is great, a free record. And then it says, do you want to review a concert? And they gave me free tickets. And I'm like living large. This is great. And then, though, I climbed the ladder. I worked in it for pornography for a while, and I used to get free porn at the time when pornography was actually expensive. And I used to be able to give my friends like all these videotapes, which was crazy because that made me very popular. But then I landed at High Times, where I got free drugs.
Wow.
Yeah, I never took advantage of the drugs when I worked at
High Times. The problem with High Times, of course, was if you ever like seen like at a kid's birthday party when they break open the pinata and 30 little kids turn into like craven little monsters. It's like Lord of the Flies. That's what it was like at High Times anytime any pot came in the office. So to get a piece of that centerfold weed was difficult, and it took some finagling, and there was a hierarchy, and again, like Planet of the Apes with the orangutans and the gorillas and the chimpanzees. But it was nice though to get some centerfold weed and say to my friends, hey, this is some centerfold weed, we're smoking the centerfold.
I remember when at my job at Condé Nast, all the different editors got swag. I didn't, because I didn't talk to anyone directly. I was the writer and the editor there, so they were the ones talking to the different companies. And I just remember, like, over the wall of the cubicle, the shoe editor like suddenly stood up and was like, I just won a Vespa.
Oh, my God.
It's just like out of the blue, just in the middle of the day, suddenly he won a Vespa. I don't know.
My favorite, I used to send out emails. This is before blogging, really. I used to send out emails every day to my friends about stuff I overheard at Condé Nast. And my favorite was this editor, who I'm sure you know, I'll tell you his name off the air. He got up and asked, is the term jungle bunny considered derogatory? Oh my God. It's this rarefied, crazy white world.
Yeah.
And when we got off for Martin Luther King Day, I was like, why? What's the point?
The black guy complained.
Yeah.
The only time I've ever met people who work for the New Yorker, they look exactly what the way Mad Magazine would draw someone who worked at the New Yorker, if you can imagine, with like pleated khakis, penny loafers, Argyle socks, sweater vest, and within 10 minutes, they let you know they went to either Harvard or Yale.
And it's incredible because those people have such great physical stamina because my body breaks down if I work in an office. Like, I got kidney stones when I worked at, I just,
oh, really?
My, yeah, I can't do it.
It's
like my body
fluorescent
can't.
Lighting.
Yeah. And but then these people are so dressed to the nines, but they're just so totally like they're up in the morning and they're, you know what I mean? I don't know. They're
perky. They're a perky lot.
They're different. Yeah. They're like a different species. When I was there, I was like the poorest and the fattest. So at Christmas, when all the snacks came in, they thought it was really cute to put the snack table in front of my cubicle.
Cute.
Yeah,
cute.
That was really adorable.
Nice.
They were
nice.
Really nice. One girl had a mirror to her monitor.
Some guy's being invested by the NFL for like the same sort of behavior right now. That's awful.
Yeah, they're, one day someone told me I smelled good and I was like, I'm starting to fit in.
Mike, tell us more about the junket at Dixon Place. Where is it exactly? When is it exactly? And how do we find it?
Dixon Place, you can just go on to dixonplace.org. And the show, unless it gets extended, is next Friday and Saturday at 10 p.m.
I get a lot of things about extensions in my email. I'll look for one, see if I can help you out. There's a lot of that in my spam file.
Good.
Thank you so much for coming to the show,
Thank
Mike.
Thank you, guys.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's always nice to be here.
Always, Mike. Good to see you. All right. Once again, it's been the fastest half hour on the internet today. So for Judy McGuire and Mike Albo, Mike Edison, and let's not forget Joe King of the Engineers in the booth. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.